that is manifested in this program and in the special themes that are discussed each year. I always am very grateful and very honored by the invitation to be with the Get Well congregation because, as Brother Elkins mentioned a moment ago, I've had a long association with this congregation. In fact, in July of this year, I had been associated with this congregation in some capacity or another for a period of 20 years. So in the years that I've been preaching, most of that time has been associated to some extent or another with the Get Well congregation in Memphis. Both of my children were baptized here. I had the opportunity to baptize both of them in the baptistry that is here. My wife and I had only been married 2 years when we moved to Memphis and began work with this congregation. That gives you an idea, since one of our daughters is now in college, of the number of years that we have been associated with this work. I appreciated a moment ago the introduction of the elders of this congregation. I think not only of them, but of others who have served in that capacity and of the influence that they have wrought in this community. And all of the association that I've enjoyed with these people and those who are members of the congregation and with Brother Elkins and his family since he's been here, all of this has been a very wonderful experience for me. So for many reasons, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be with you again this evening and to be able to speak on this program. I also want to mention that I appreciate the presence of a goodly number tonight from the South Haven, Mississippi congregation because they now listen to me every Sunday, and I appreciate the fact that they were willing to come again tonight in large number and to be present with us in this service as well. As all of you know, the overall theme of this series of lectures has to do with the home. The home as God would have it. And added to that, in further consideration of the subject, is and contemporary attacks against it. And I've been asked to speak especially on the subject of the breakdown of respect for authority. I want to read a couple of passages just to serve as a basis for our thinking. You remember in the Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 18, that Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, "All power or authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth." And then further in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and in verse 27, it is said, "For he hath put all things under his feet. But when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, which did put all things under him." Now I understand this to say that all authority ultimately emanates from God. And I believe that there are tiers of authority or levels of authority that must be respected and recognized. And I suppose that every one of us at this point understands the need of authority. I know that we realize that if there were not some authority in society or in civilization, we would have chaos. If half the people wanted to drive on the right hand of the street as we do in the United States and the other half on the left side of the street as they do in certain places in Europe, we'd have a very difficult and congested situation that would be detrimental to the safety of all of us. In fact, some people do not regard authority and drive on the wrong side of the road anyway. But if we did not have some authority, we would have chaos in our society. The same is true in regard to measurements. There must be some standard measurement of what is a foot or what is a yard. There must be some standard measurement of how many ounces in a pound. There must be proper weights and measures in order that when one orders so many yards of cloth, he knows what he's going to get, or so many ounces of a substance, or so many pounds of something. So all of us recognize, not merely in a religious or a spiritual way, but in our everyday affairs, that there must be some standard of authority. And we know that there is a need for authority in order for us to exist and in order for us to have an orderly civilization. I'm firmly committed to the proposition that the place where respect for authority begins is in the home. And I think that needs to be emphasized in view of the fact that the overall theme of this lecture series has to do with the home. And inasmuch as I'm speaking on that particular facet of the breakdown of respect for authority, I think it is important to emphasize how the breakdown of respect for authority is related to the situation that exists within the homes of our nation. And during the course of our study tonight, I want to refer to some other problems in connection with authority. But I want to stress especially this matter of the respect for authority that must be generated within the homes of our nation. All of us, I'm sure, remember the statement that is made in the 6th chapter of the book of Ephesians, in which it is said, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." In reading that passage, I'm impressed with the fact that there is a dual responsibility. There is a responsibility first upon the children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Then there is a responsibility also upon the parents, fathers, as the head of the house. And of course, by delegation to those that are in control of the home. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. That shows that there is not only a responsibility upon the child to obey, but there is likewise a responsibility upon the parent to provide the right kind of leadership within the home. In Colossians chapter 3 and in verse 20, "Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord." You remember that in the Old Testament, Eli was condemned because he restrained not his children. And that further indicates the fact there was not only a responsibility upon his sons to obey, but he had a responsibility himself to provide the right kind of leadership or the right kind of authority within the home. And not only were his sons condemned because of their failure, but he was likewise condemned because he did not exercise his parental responsibility. There are many statements that are found in the Proverbs. Proverbs 1:8, "My son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother." Proverbs 6 and verse 20, "My son, keep thy father's commandment, and forsake not the law of thy mother." The Word of God is replete with instructions about the home. And in those instructions about the home, there is that dual responsibility constantly emphasized, that first the parent must exercise the right kind of leadership or authority within the home. And then the child has a responsibility to be submissive to that authority, and I like the reasons that are given for that. Ephesians 6 and verse 1 simply says, "For this is right." Colossians 3 and verse 20 says, "It is well-pleasing unto God." And furthermore, you remember in the first chapter of the book of Romans, about verse 20, in talking about some of the sins that were prevalent in that day among the Gentiles, those who really seemed to have no moral restraint whatsoever, that one of the sins that is listed there, along with the blackest and the darkest catalog of sins conceivable to the human mind, is this: disobedience unto parents. So this matter of authority in the home, exercised by the parents and accepted by the children who are a part of that home, is no small matter. It is something that is presented with the greatest significance and the greatest gravity in the Word of God. And yet there seems to be a lack of respect for authority in all segments of our society. And I submit the reason for that is because it has not begun in a proper way, in the proper place, in the home, which is the cradle of our society. I have some statements here that were made in a speech and later printed as an article by Dr. Harold M. Vaught, M.D., first given as an address at the National Defense Luncheon in Washington, D.C., April 17, 1978. Later printed in an Alabama medical journal and finally made available in the way that I saw it through the biblical notes for December 1978 by Brother Roy Deaver. And I believe that Brother Deaver has performed a real service in making this material more generally available. It is some of the most thought-provoking statements that I have read, one of the most thought-provoking analysis of the American home situation that I've seen. And I want to take the liberty to refer just to a few of the things that are stated here by Dr. Vaught. This man, incidentally, is the senior psychiatrist and psychoanalyst at the Menninger Foundation in Topeka, Kansas. He says, this is a grave time in the history of our nation. Changes are taking place in our way of life and in our national character, which have lowered and will continue to lower the vitality of our people, the quality of our institutions and our basic values. The inevitable result is that we will undergo a progressive disintegration and possibly the eventual collapse of our democracy. When sufficiently disintegrated, forces either within our borders of a revolutionary nature or external forces will overwhelm what is left of America. The American dream will be over. He further says, we are, however, all on a passing train. As we pass through this life, each individual supports certain values, traditions, and institutions that make numerous contributions to society. Then suddenly death comes and our influence ends. And this is a very sobering thought to me, if I may digress a moment from the statement I'm reading from Dr. Vaught. I think about, for example, this congregation as an illustration of what I'm trying to say. Here is a congregation that has been overseen by men who are faithful and able, served by others of that type and character. And yet we wonder, as these pass away, who shall arise to take their place? And what I say about this congregation is applicable to every other congregation of God's people, and applicable not only in congregations, but in our individual spheres of influence. Now here's what Dr. Vaught says about that. Suddenly death comes and our influence ends. I don't believe our influence entirely terminates by death, but I understand there is a sense in which it does. New individuals take our place. But what will these new Americans be like? What values and patterns of living will they support? Will they advance our traditions to new and higher levels of excellence? Or will they implement ways of life that lead to disintegration and decay? In my opinion, there is no question about the direction America is taking. We are deteriorating at an alarming rate. He says individual vitality is not a mysterious phenomenon. We know where it comes from. A newborn child contains great potential. But in order for that potential to be unlocked, evoked, developed, and expressed, certain fundamental events must take place early in life. And now you begin to see the reason why, in a study about the home and about the breakdown of respect for authority generally, that I'm quoting from the words of this individual. He's first laid out the fact that there is a deteriorating condition in our nation. And then, having shown the problems that we face and confront as a nation, he points to the future and says that someday each of us will pass away from the scenes of this life's activities. And behind us, there must come someone else. And that is true as a nation, that is true with national leadership, that is true in governmental positions, and it is true in the Church of the Lord. That means that there must be others to step into the places of leadership. There must be others that will be able to step into the shoes of elders. That means there must be others that will be able to occupy the pulpits and who will be able to write and to direct the thinking of others in years to come. And then he begins to talk about what is going to shape the influence of those that will take these places in generations yet to come. He says a newborn child contains great potential, but in order for that potential to be unlocked, evoked, developed, and expressed, certain fundamental events must take place early in life. When these events occur imperfectly or do not occur at all, the developing child will become a social liability in one form or another, rather than an asset. Or if he becomes an asset, may never achieve his full potential. Now here he is beginning to emphasize what we've known from the principles of the Word of God for all of these years. And what I'm glad to see being recognized by others in other fields of endeavor. And that is that there is an influence that is wrought in the home as the cradle of society, as the most influential institution of our civilization, that is going to determine the kind of attitudes, the kind of respect or lack of respect that people will have in the emerging years. Then if I may look just a little further at a statement that is made here. He says the most obvious consequence of disturbed childhood development is the ability to make lasting commitments. Now hear this. Especially fragile is the heterosexual commitment and the ability to produce children and to take good care of them, so that they will grow up to be healthy men and women. Look at what is happening in our country. The overall divorce rate is now 40%. You know, for a number of years we've been saying that there was one divorce to every four marriages. And that has been true for a good long while, but it is apparently no longer true. The breakdown in the home now is approaching the figure of one out of two instead of one out of four. It has nearly doubled. Dr. Voth here says it is 40%. Not very far away from the halfway mark. That is, 100 couples are married, line them up here. On the average, 50 out of that 100 couples that marry will see that marriage terminated by divorce. The overall divorce rate is now 40%. And 59% of second marriages end in divorce. So that is a reduplication of that occurrence. He says further, in California, more young people are living together than are formally married. Now think about that. Here is something that may have occurred a number of years ago, but it was considered a social disgrace. Certainly no one bragged about it, no one boasted about it, and if possible, no one let it be known. But now then, it is an open and notorious situation, and it is one of the assaults or the contemporary attacks against the home as presented in the Bible. The fact that now then, homes are made up, if they may be called such, not based upon the purity of the marriage relationship, but merely a live-in agreement. And it is shocking to me to consider the statement made by this authority when he says, in California, more young people are living together than are formally married. The number of unmarried couples in the United States has doubled between 1970 and 1975. Currently, there are 1.3 million such couples. Now, here is his concluding statement in that connection, and I particularly want to emphasize this because I believe it is so true. Those who are living together have answered nature's mating call, but they lack the psychological wherewithal to make the commitment stick. Now here is a part of that breakdown for the respective authority. There are people who are in their homes not giving any impetus to the idea of proper respect for duly constituted authority. Because in all too many instances, the sacred relationship of marriage itself is not respected. Children are brought into an environment where that they themselves could scarcely ever learn to form the kind of commitments that make for a healthy, happy, psychologically firm, to say nothing of scriptural, relationship. He says the children of these incomplete commitments or those from the millions of broken homes will rarely develop their full potential. Now, please bear in mind that the statement that I'm reading is not from a preacher, not from a theologian, not from a philosopher, but statements that are made by a senior psychiatrist at one of the most famous hospitals in the world, the Menninger Foundation in Topeka, Kansas. The children of these incomplete commitments are those from the millions of broken homes, he says, will rarely develop their full potential, and many will become the social liabilities of tomorrow to one degree or another. Furthermore, the suffering and psychiatric illnesses these individuals will endure defy estimation. When I began to study these things and to look at what is happening in our modern society, I'm impressed all the more with the fact that God knew what he was doing. I know, as an academic matter, all of us know that. We know the wisdom of God is wiser than men. But when we begin to see the situations that are existing, for example, he refers here to the terrible toll of psychological and mental illnesses. Some years ago, someone wrote a book called Every Other Bed, in which they were saying that every other person who is now in the hospital actually has some type of psychiatric problem or mental difficulty. When we begin to realize the problems and the stresses of our modern-day civilization and the difficulties that are increasing day by day, the lack of real firm moral character in our nation, and we begin to trace that back, we begin to see that it emanates from a breakdown of the home, the marriage relationship, as God actually intended for it to be. I had the opportunity to work here in Memphis for about 5 years with the juvenile court of Memphis and Shelby County, which is one of the largest juvenile courts in the United States. Part of my responsibility from year to year was to keep statistical data to see what we were confronting and to try to understand and to isolate the problems as nearly as we could. Over and over again, year after year, I learned this. We were dealing with a number of categories of children. We had some children that were known as delinquents. Under Tennessee law, a delinquent child is one who is guilty of an offense that would be a crime for an adult. Now, the legislatures generally have tried to protect juveniles from the consequences of their own misdeeds. And so when a juvenile commits an act, it is not described as a crime or as a criminal act, but as a delinquent act. But then when you go on to read the definition of that in the statutes, it will tell you that this is the same kind of act that, if committed by an adult, would be called a crime. But because it is a juvenile, it is referred to as a delinquent act. So we dealt with children that were known as delinquent, and they were simply children that committed criminal offenses. We dealt with other children that, under Tennessee law, were referred to as unruly children. An unruly child is one that is guilty of an offense that would not be a crime for an adult, but is applicable only to a child, that is, one under 18 years of age here. So the delinquent child is one that commits an act such as burglary, robbery, rape, or murder that would be a crime for an adult. An unruly child is one that commits an offense that is applicable only to a child and would not be a crime for an adult, such as possession of alcoholic beverages, truancy from school, run away from home, are habitually disobedient. Lumping together those children that were found to be unruly and delinquent and looking at the home background, I found that year after year after year, that only about 35 or 36% of those children came out of homes where the parents were married and living together in the home. That means that nearly two-thirds of all of the unruly and delinquent children that came to the attention of the court in this area came out of homes that were broken or disorganized to some degree or another. We also dealt with another category of children known as dependent and neglected children, which again, under Tennessee law, refers to a child who has not done anything wrong, as in the case of the delinquent or the unruly child, but a child who has been wrong. That is, a child who has been the subject of abuse, neglect, abandonment, or some other wrong against the child that caused that child to be in a dependent or neglected situation. A again examining the figures in relation to those children and the family backgrounds out of which they came, it was even more startling, only on the average about 8 to 10% of dependent and neglected children came out of homes where the parents were married and living together in the home. When you consider the fact that some two-thirds of all delinquent and unruly children right in this very community, and some 90 to 92% of all dependent, neglected, abused, forsaken, and abandoned children right in this very community came out of homes where that there was a broken or disorganized situation, it is too much merely to be coincidence. It manifests that the real problem that exists in our society goes back to and relates generically to the home. And I found something else, my observation, that I thought was quite interesting. Most of the children who got into trouble did not come out of that great middle area in the economic and social strata. Most of them came out of the extremities, that is, either the very poor homes, those that were in the poverty level, or, interestingly enough, on the other side, those that were in the well-to-do, wealthy, or affluent level. You know, I began to ask myself about that. Why in the world would that be true? Why would it be true that those that would have the greatest amount of difficulty would be those out of the poverty level on the one hand, or those out of the level of affluence on the other hand, and there are more of those from those extremities that get into trouble than those from the middle area of life? And it did not take me long to discover what the reason was. In each of the cases, it was simply a lack of parental supervision within the home. On the poverty level, I discovered that many of the parents worked two jobs. One job during the day, another job at night. I also discovered that on the poverty level, there were many, many one-parent homes. Not only that, but on the poverty level, if they did not work two jobs, it may be that they did not work at all, and that they roamed the streets at night. But I soon discovered that the reason that so many children on that level got into problems and difficulties was because of the absent parent, the parent so often who was not in the home, and there was no real authority figure within those homes. And then lo and behold, when I looked to the opposite end and found those parents who were well-to-do having many of the same problems, lo and behold again, it was discovered it was the same type of situation. Because they were so involved in social events, because they were so involved with their clubs and organizations, because they had time for anything and everything else in the world besides their homes and their children, there was also a lack of supervision there. And in both cases where children got into trouble, the root cause was a lack of proper parental supervision within the home. No authority. You know, I was interested to read a few years ago, I believe it was the University of Wisconsin, who decided that they would conduct a study of a number of homes in their area to discover if the parents knew where their children were at night. And they made a number of calls one night about midnight to ask the parents, "Do you know where their children were?" But I read that they discontinued the study because so many of the calls were answered by children who didn't know where their parents were. Now that underscores the problem and indicates that the breakdown of respect for authority emanates eventually from the home. That's why there are so many difficulties in our society, is because there is a lack of an authority figure within the home. There is a lack of proper parental supervision in the home. And as a consequence of that, there is a carryover effect into other areas and avenues of life. For example, in the fourth chapter of the book of Galatians, verses 1 and 2, the Apostle Paul says, "Now, I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, differeth nothing from a servant, though he be Lord of all, but is under tutors and governors or guardians until the time appointed of the father. Now, that merely states scripturally what we know to be a correct principle. That a child, as long as he is a minor, is under certain guardians and tutors until such time as he is of age. You have that every day. You commit your children to the teachers in the schools. They are tutors and guardians of those children, and by delegation of your parental authority, they have the authority over those children during certain times of their lives. We not only have the problems that exist within the homes that carry over into our society, but we see it in every aspect of life. You see it now in the school systems around our nation. And I might here refer to another statement that was made by Dr. Vaught in the same speech or address from which I read a moment ago that I thought quite interesting in regard to our schools. He said, in view of the deterioration of family life, it is no wonder that in 1 year, 70,000 assaults were made on teachers, that 100 murders were committed in schools, and that $1 billion worth of property damage was done to schools. Schools of large cities reflect decay. Students in big cities are 4 to 5 years behind the level of achievement of children from smaller cities. These children are full of rage as a result. Now listen why this occurs. I said the place where that authority begins is by teaching proper parental authority within the home, and it carries over into other areas of life, such as in the tutors and guardians. For example, in the school system, now, here is his analysis of the situation. These children are full of rage as a result of emotional deprivations and the lack of authority within the home. They lack the inner controls to abide by external rules, by simple codes of human conduct. You know, part of the modernistic influence in our society today is that which says, and you see it occasionally on placards and posters and bumper stickers, if it feels good, do it. That's about as false as anything that ever emanated from the pits of hell. That is the idea that says there are no external controls. Everything is subjective. Everything is within. And that philosophy has been carried over into religion. That's why people say, well, to some people it is good to be an atheist. To some people it is good to be of one religion. To some it is good to be another. It depends upon the subjective feeling within the individual. They don't believe in external controls. And it is said here that that is a carryover from the problems that exist from within the homes. These children are full of rage as a result of emotional deprivations and the lack of authority within the home. They lack the inner controls to abide by external rules, by simple codes of human conduct. How can they be expected to behave in a civilized manner when they were deprived of civilizing experiences at home? And that simply means that at home, they must learn how to respect external authority and to be submissive to it. If they don't learn that in the home, they're going to have problems in the school system. They're going to have problems with law enforcement in society. They're going to have problems recognizing divine authority. And they're going to have problems all the way down the road of life wherever they go. I've seen this over and over again, and I've heard it from educators. Parents may tell their children the ABCs. Our parents may want to give their children a little head start in school. They teach them to count from 1 to 100. But educators will tell you in a moment, that does not give the child much advantage. I don't know that there's any harm to it. But it will not be long until other students in the classroom can say the ABCs, and they're up with this student that learned it before he started to school. Others will soon learn to count from 1 to 100, but the teachers say that the children that really have the built-in advantage when they get into the school system are the children who have been taught proper respect for authority within the home. Because those are the children who listen when the teacher gives instructions. Those are the children who understand what authority is, what an authority figure is. Those are the children who understand when the children receive directions for their homework. They know what it is. They know how to follow directions on an examination or a test that is given unto them. The real advantage that is built in for the child when he goes to school is not whether he can count to 100. It's not whether he can say his ABCs. The real built-in advantage is if a child has been taught respect for authority within the home, because there is a spillover effect into the schools. And then the children know how to respect the teacher. You have the same spillover effect, of course, into the area of our society. I hardly need to say anything about the crime rate today and about the large number of those that commit crimes that are under 21 years of age. The majority of crimes that are committed in this country today are committed by those who are under 21. A number of years ago, and I'm sure the figure is greater now, the cost of crime in our country was over $51 billion per year, which averages out to a cost of about $1,000 per family every year in this country. That's what we pay just for crime. From 1961 to 1965, the cost of police forces in our country doubled. And crime has been increasing more than 10 times faster than the rate of our growth of population. Now, what is the cause of that? I do not believe that I'm being at all naive, nor that I'm overstating the case, when I say that just as children that do not learn proper respect for authority in the home have difficulty in the school systems, they are the ones more often than not that have difficulties in the law enforcement system of the country. Romans 13:1 says the powers that be are ordained of God, and there is no power but of God. Verse 4 talks about how the civil ruler is a minister of God to execute wrath upon them that do evil. This is simply bound up in the whole idea of respect for properly constituted authority. And it must be learned at the mother's knee and sometimes over the father's. And then I must refer to the fact, too, that as there is a spillover effect from the home into the school system and finally into the society in which we live, this also has a significant bearing upon regard for divine authority. I mentioned a while ago in the outset of our study that all authority actually emanates from God, ultimately. The authority of the parent emanates from God. The authority of the guardians and tutors emanates from God. Certainly the authority vested in civil rulers emanates from God. You remember that Jesus told Pilate that he had no authority except it had been given him from above. So all authority eventually emanates from God. And that underscores, too, the importance of this principle that if one does not learn the respect for authority on the lowest level, in the very beginning years of life and in the formative period of life, how can one be expected to have proper respect for God and for things that are sacred and divine in later years? I ran across this statement. It was quoted by Brother Wayne Jackson in his book, Fortify Your Faith, by Dr. Joshua Liebman in his book, Peace of Mind, in which he said, I believe that much atheism has the ground prepared for it in the disillusionment with the parent which has arisen in the child. Disbelief in life, skepticism about humanity, the denial of God, all sink their roots in the soil of emotion long before exposure to courses in philosophy and science. Life has scared such people early and has made them unwilling to believe either in man or in God. I wonder sometimes how well we think about the influence and the impact of those formative years of children upon whether they will succeed in their studies, whether they will be law-abiding in their community, citizens of their nation, and eventually whether they will be able to recognize and to appreciate the authority of God Almighty. If we don't start it here, they won't have it here.